If you turned on the Bravo network many years ago, you'd see high art, a ballet or an opera. Now you get glossy competition shows like Top Chef. Tonight, Bravo is bringing together the art and the competition in a new series called Work of Art, The Next Great Artist. Think of it as American Artistic Idol. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports that the winner gets $100,000 and a show at the Brooklyn Museum.
The format is exactly like Top Chef and Project Runway. There's a group of contestants, in this case 14 very different artists, painters, video artists, photographers.
I spent a lot of time flipping burgers during the day and then in the afternoon shooting scantily clad models in weird costumes.
There's the mentor, the Tim Gunn figure from Project Runway. On Work of Art, it's Simone de Puri of the auction house Phillips de Puri & Company.
I'm very impressed in terms of processing. It's first rate and I hope that the result will be equally first rate.
Me too.
The artists have to create under a tight deadline.
You have until midnight tonight.
And the personalities clash.
That triangle painting, it's not so good.
Naya's really rude.
And at the end of each episode, somebody goes home. The producers who brought us Project Runway and Top Chef are also behind Work of Art. They say, if it ain't broke...
Maybe that's creatively unambitious, but this formula kind of works.
Dan Cutworth and his partner Jane Lipsitz say they're also sticking with the familiar because the art world could intimidate the audience.
You know, everyone felt that putting it against the backdrop of a familiar format was the way to make people feel comfortable.
I'm really into lilies right now.
Lilies.
And hermaphrodites.
The judges include an art critic and two gallery owners. The winning artist will have a show at the Brooklyn Museum.
And this is the gallery.
Brooklyn Museum Director for Art, Charles Demaray, shows off a smallish gallery where the winner's work will be displayed. He says he has no qualms about giving space, not far from American masters like Georgia O'Keeffe, to an artist whose claim to fame is winning a reality TV show.
I find it very much like the juried show. And the juried show was meant to introduce artists and to give artists opportunities that didn't go through the normal channels, and so that everybody could submit their work. So I don't know. I don't think it's all that different.
But there are some differences. In a juried show, the artists most likely haven't been filmed while they work, in the same room at the same time as their competitors, not to mention live together.
I've never stayed in a place like this. I've been sleeping in my truck and sleeping at my parents' house.
Whatever it is, these 14 young artists might get ahead quicker in their careers because of the exposure. At least that's what Andres Serrano thinks. Serrano is perhaps best known as one of the artists at the center of the culture wars of the 1980s. He's one of a handful of artists who appear on the new Bravo show.
No shocking work sometimes is not even meant to be shocking.
When the producers first asked Serrano to be on the TV show, he says he was a little skeptical.
Actually, I was surprised that I felt the show was good, and so I was pleasantly surprised. It was very meaningful.
He had only one concern.
I wanted to make sure that I looked good on camera, and I think I did, you know.
The winner of Bravo's new reality series, Work of Art, will have a show at the Brooklyn Museum right near a show by Andy Warhol. It's anyone's guess whether the winner's fame will last more than 15 minutes. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This Sunday, HBO's vampire series True Blood returns with its third season. Our TV critic David Bianculli says True Blood is different from other vampire dramas appearing on screen these days, including the phenomenally popular Twilight movies. True Blood, he says, is not about denial and restraint. It's about giving in.
I have a friend who teaches a college course in vampires in literature and pop culture. And he teaches a theory that at first I laughed at, but have come to accept. His idea is that on film, from the screen-silent Nosferatu to the still-creepy Dracula with Bela Lugosi, vampires were depicted as predatory creatures without a conscience, with a thirst for killing as well as blood. Then, in the 1960s, along came a screen vampire who changed all that, who injected angst into the mix, and presented a vampire haunted by his own immortality and appetites. This new approach, of course, worked well for Frank Langella's swoony vampire in the 80s, and for every undead sex symbol since. On TV, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel wouldn't otherwise exist. Nor would the hunky anti-hero of TV's Moonlight or the brooding teens of the cinematic Twilight saga. And who was this pop culture vampire who changed the undead zeitgeist in the 60s? According to this theory, ready? It was Barnabas Collins, the moody vampire played by Jonathan Frid in TV's daytime gothic soap opera, Dark Shadows. I resisted this idea because, to me, Jonathan Frid, as an actor, was more wooden than any of the stakes used as weapons against him. But True Blood, the HBO vampire series created by Alan Ball, offers the best proof that this theory holds water, if not blood. True Blood doesn't even try to hide its origins, its genre, or its intentions. Like Dark Shadows, it's a soap opera, pure and simple. Or, more accurately, it's a soap opera, impure and complicated. The third season begins Sunday and picks up at the very place last year's cliffhanger left off. Bill Compton, the vampire lover of southern waitress Sookie Stackhouse, has gone missing. Sookie suspects foul play. And in the universe of True Blood, where vampires coexist with humans openly, and where shapeshifters, demons, and other creatures lurk in the shadows, she'd be foolish to think otherwise. So she bravely and boldly stomps into a vampire nightclub called Fangtasia and demands to see the owner. Eric, a powerful vampire in charge of things in this bayou backwater. He also has a crush on Sookie and isn't shy about admitting it. So far, this particular plot could have been pulled from just about any vampire drama. But where True Blood veers into uncharted territory is in its unapologetic hedonism. Sookie finds Eric in the basement of his nightclub, all right, and confronts him, just as you'd expect. But what's unexpected and different is that she finds him having violent sex with a woman who's tied to a wall, a woman who appears both willing and worn out. And when Eric turns his attention to Sookie, he remains naked throughout the entire scene. Needless to say, this isn't Twilight, which is more about denial and refusal than attraction and giving in. Anna Paquin stars as Sookie. Alexander Skarsgård plays Eric.
Sookie, meet my new dancer, Iveta, from Estonia. Iveta, meet Sookie, from here.
Здравствуйте. Hi.
Which is? So, what brings you to Fantasia on this balmy summer night?
Bill's been kidnapped, and I think you did it.
I didn't. Any other theories?
I'm still on this one, thank you very much. Where were you tonight around 11 o'clock?
Here, with Iveta.
Doing this? For the last 6 hours?
You seem surprised. Is Bill's stamina not up to snuff?
Tell me where I can find Lorena. If you don't have him, she does.
Solid theory. But given the tenor of your last run-in with Miss Krasicki, I think it's better if I dealt with her instead.
How do I know you will?
Because if Bill was in fact kidnapped, by human or vampire, I am duty-bound as sheriff of the area in which he resides to find him. Even if I do want what is his.
Then do it.
There's a lot of stuff going on this season, including the introduction of new characters. Werewolves, for example, but a very different breed than in the Twilight films. But what's most refreshing and most impressive are the new takes this season on the established characters. Sookie's brother Jason and their friend Lafayette, who were two of the wildest and least responsible characters in True Blood, emerge this season as two of the more dependable ones. That's partly because other folks have either vanished or regressed, but it's also because these two southern wild men have learned from their mistakes. And Stephen Moyer, as Sookie's kidnapped Bill, is as magnetic and mysterious as ever. A far, far cry from Barnabas Collins. But hey, this is soap opera, just like the books by Charlaine Harris on which True Blood is based. And Alan Ball and company have injected new blood into their show, so to speak, by giving more screen time to some especially entertaining female vampires. Deborah Ann Wall as Jessica, Bill's young vampire in training, and Kristen Bauer as Pam, Eric's unflappable manager at Fangtasia. I've seen the first three of this season's new shows, and once again, I'm hooked. Or maybe, in this case, I'm bitten.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. You can find links to Fresh Air interviews with the star of True Blood, Anna Paquin, and the series creator, Alan Ball, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Lizards, Little Orphan Annie's adventures are coming to an end in the funny papers today. The comic strip has been running since Harold Gray created the red-headed, saucer-eyed character in 1924. Jay Mader has been the writer for Orphan Annie since 2000 and is on the phone from Texas. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Tell us, what did Harold Gray have in mind when he created what is now the iconic Annie?
He originally created Little Orphan Otto. As a matter of fact, who was a plucky little lad. And the New York Daily News decided that Otto ought to be Annie instead.
Tell us how the comic and the character reflected the times when it was first published and Harold Gray's point of view.
She was just an adventurous little kid who didn't really have to be accountable to anybody because she was mostly concerned with her own everyday survival. And she hooked up with Oliver Warbucks at a certain point fairly early on, who became her protector. And he was, of course, the richest guy on the entire planet, a very powerful industrialist, who over time began to reflect Harold Gray's crusty, arch-conservative, 19th-century Midwestern political views.
This was a dark comic. I mean, this was kind of an eerie comic in the early days, was it not?
Very dark.
Yeah.
Very paranoid. Not necessarily without good reason, you understand. Very much unlike the contemporary perception that people have of Annie strictly from the basis of the Broadway musical and the movie, you know, which is of this happily chirping little kid running around saying, I love you tomorrow, and so on and so forth. That's not Annie at all. That's not the comic strip Annie.
Yeah, who's the comic strip Annie now?
Who is she now? What she has been under my stewardship. Globetrotting, adventurous kid, usually in the company of a lady named Amelia Santiago, who is an ex-Marine, ex-CIA agent, who does a lot of undercover work for both Oliver Warbucks and the U.S. military around the world.
Jay Mader is the current writer for the Orphan Annie comic strip, which ends in newspapers today. Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks so much.
Who's that little chatterbox? The one with pretty auburn locks. Whom do you see? It's little orphan Annie. Bright eyes, cheeks of rosy glow. There's a store of healthiness handy. Might size, always on the go. If you want to know, fine.